Good evening, James McCanny with my Science Hour. This is for February 20th, 2020. It's a lot of 20s there. 2020. How many times is that going to happen? Must mean something significant. Anyway, a lot of topics to cover. First of all, this story, I'm amazed. I'm actually truly amazed. But this was in space.com. And to give you a date, it appeared on the 14th of February here, but it started back in 2019 when a comet was discovered. It's called 2I, I as in Ignatius, Borisov. And so Borisov is a guy who frequently discovers comets. He's an amateur. And so this one bears his name. And anyway, this, as it turns out, this comet was coming in from interstellar space. And so that means that it was coming from beyond our own solar system. It's the first time it has encountered our sun. And so this is the second one in a matter of a couple of years. There was the other one. I don't remember how to pronounce the name. It's a Wuma Zoo or... I don't know. That's not right. But it's kind of a funny name, probably a Japanese name or something. But that one was claimed to have come in from interstellar space, and they claimed, well, that's the first one. Well, clearly in the history of the solar system, it's not the first one. It's potentially, there could be any number of these that have occurred during the history of the solar system, an object coming in from outside the gravitational well of our very own sun. But what's interesting here, what just about I had to get up off the floor after I read this, is the SETI group, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI, was looking at this. Listen to this. Searching for signs of alien technosignatures. In other words, they were looking to see if there was some kind of intelligence associated with this object that may have been sent here from some other solar system, whatever. But remember back in the, when was this? Back in the early 2000s, I was a speaker at UFO Congress. And one of my topics, this is goes back actually decades to the year, the mid-1980s, when I was promoting my electromagnetic propulsion systems out in Los Angeles. And I've told this story before. That's where I first met the elite of the world, the so-called secret societies, and their kids, and the venture capital firms hanging around Palos Verde and other places around Los Angeles. So anyway, to get back to this story, when I gave the second talk at the UFO Congress, I was releasing my book, the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. And in there, I have a drawing which was published as my article published in the IEEE magazine relative to an electric propulsion system. And I had been giving talks about this at closed military meetings, various other places. But there's a term that I coined, and it basically electric rivers to the stars. In other words, I had discovered that there were electric currents flowing between the stars. And there's a reason for that. It's the same reason that there's currents flowing in the solar system. It's the fusion-based capacitor in our solar system coming from the sun. But in the galactic environment, of which our star is a member, out in the distant boondocks of the galaxy, but there's a current flow that flows down the galactic arms, and this is a discharge of the galactic capacitor. And so, I could give a lot of other information about this, but there is a way for us to ride these rivers, just like the ancient ships of old would go with the trade winds. They would follow these currents, and there is a way to actually use them, just like And it's not a sale. It's not a sale. I will say that. But anyway, the talk I gave at the UFO Congress and, like I say, at other places, closed meetings, the 19th International Electric Propulsion Meeting in Colorado Springs, and other places. These were closed-door military meetings and some other locations. I talked about the use of comets for braking and accelerating. When you go out of the solar system, you would accelerate. When you would come into the solar system, you would use the comet electrical discharge for braking, for putting on the brakes, literally coming in the solar system, which, of course, now here's the juicy part with all of this introduction. Here is the juicy part. Remember back in the Hale-Bopp days. Now, Hale-Bopp was a comet was discovered in 1995 officially by Hale. It was a Thomas Hale, and I forget Bopp's first name. But they both discovered it on the same night, so they both got credit. So it was called Hale-Bopp. And that's when it exploded into brightness, but it had literally been discovered 5 years earlier by Dr. Robert Harrington, who is the head of the Naval Observatory. And this was part of a search that was paid for by NASA. It was called the Search for Planet X. And this goes back to the Sitchin days back in the mid-80s, where Zachariah Sitchin was studying texts of the Sumerians and was interested in this object called Nibiru. And so anyway, he went and interviewed. There's a video of this. You can actually see the interview of Sitchin talking to Robert Harrington as a fairly young guy, head of the Naval Observatory, in the mid-1980s. And at that time, Harrington had already been looking for this under NASA contract. And they knew that they were looking at least one object. And that was something that was pulling down on the orbits of Uranus and Neptune. So it was down in that region of the solar system. And also Harrington was spurred to do this because of the work of a guy named Tom Van Flandern, who was his assistant in the Naval Observatory. So anyway, Sitchin comes in at the time in like 1986. You can see this interview. Harrington has an orbit, and it shows, this is their initial estimates. They haven't seen the object yet. They know that something's pulling down on the orbits of Uranus and Neptune. Astronomy is a very exacting science, so they had some kind of an idea. So they had an estimate that it may have had an orbit of about 3,600 years. That is where the infamous 3,600-year orbit for Nibiru came from. But it was wrong. It was wrong. And it turns out that the object actually had a 4,200-year orbit, or possibly a bit longer. But 3,600 years is not too far out. But Sitchin turns around and publishes this, blasts it all over the place. And then when the Planet X rage begins in the late 1990s and early 2000s with the crazy lady talks to aliens, you know, Planet X coming, we're all going to die thing. And I spent inordinate amount of time. I wrote my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, to try and straighten out the situation. But anyway, the whole issue with Hale-Bopp, remember that when it was first discovered, Courtney Brown got an image from NASA and sent it to Art Bell. And then a guy who was a friend of mine, Chuck Schrammick, lived in Houston, Texas, was a talk show host. I was a regular guest on his show. And he was highly critical of NASA. In fact, you can listen to an interview of me with Chuck on my webpage. If you scroll all the way down to the archive subpage at the very bottom, there's a link that will take you and you can listen to my interview with Chuck Schrammick before Chuck died of rapid onset cancer. And also Robert Harrington died of rapid onset cancer. Both of those guys who were instrumental in the discovery of Hale-Bopp and the publication of Hale-Bopp both died of rapid onset cancer. But anyway, that's another story. But as it turned out, both Chuck Schrammick and Courtney Brown sent their photos. Courtney Brown had gotten his from Ali Hainau from the University of Hawaii Observatory because they had been watching this thing as part of a CIA undercover operation, which happens all the time in astronomy. And so anyway, Art Bell publishes these photos on his webpage. Immediately there's a major outcry, and over a comet. I mean, what's the big deal? But this comet was not any comet. It had a companion, and all of the photographs proved this out. But anyway, to make a long story short, there was an alleged mass suicide of a group called Heaven's Gate. They lived out in Los Angeles, and they were waiting for some kind of sign to come in, for the aliens to come in. And there was, it turns out that this was not a mass suicide. It was a mass murder carried out by the CIA because the Heaven's Gate people had about 30,000 people on their way to Los Angeles. And they were going to go camp out on a hill out there in the Hollywood Hills, literally, and wait for the alien spaceship to come in and take them away. And so anyway, the last thing that the CIA wanted out of all of this was for this to get out into the public. So that's the Heaven's Gate had a mole. And by the way, the reasons they were called Heaven's Gate is because these guys were programmers. They were building, Heaven's Gate was a software program that was impenetrable. Nobody could get it into it, including the CIA, etc. And they were selling this software as a form of encryption, you know. And so anyway, that's a whole nother story. But the whole thing was that it was just denounced by everybody. What a bunch of crazy people that would think that there's a comet coming in that had alien life. How absolutely imposterous. Improbable, could not happen. What a bunch of lunatics. And now, now that I've given you this rounded out background, here comes SETI in the year 2020 looking at comets for alien technosignatures as part of their scientific venture. Wow. Now, I mean, this has come full circle. How can these people do this with a straight face? This is just beyond bizarre because I lived through all of the decades of this, the 1980s, the original search for Planet X, the 1990s, the Hale-Bopp era, the 2000s, the Planet X craze and all of that, trying to put a note of sanity into that, being accused of being one of the Planet X nutcases out there when I was the person actually putting reason into the whole thing. The same with the Hale-Bopp era. What a nutcase arena that was. And here we are in the year 2020, and SETI just happens to start to look at comets for alien technosignatures. Oh, my goodness. When I saw this, I fell off my chair. I got up on the floor, and I know this can't be real. I got up, I had to put myself back in my chair. That's how insane this whole thing is. This is absolutely bonkers, off the wall, insane. And that these people at SETI would do this and just not and expect you, the public, to go, oh yeah, oh that's part of their science program now. SETI's looking for alien technosignatures around comets. And, you know, I'm the first one that talked about this long before the Heaven's Gate thing ever occurred because I was looking at electric currents as mechanisms for propulsion systems. You know, this is 1982. I guarantee you there was nobody on this part of the galaxy that was thinking anything like that. Because I went to the meetings, I knew the military people. I went to, for example, the Space America Air Show in San Diego, That's where I met a guy named Bert Rutan. He was there and with his cowboy boots and his big sideburns. And yeah, he was demonstrating his composite aircraft, you know, construction there for the aerospace program. And I was there giving a talk on my electromagnetic propulsion systems. So anyway, a little bit of history there, fill in the blanks. But yeah, I've been around the block more than once or twice here. But to see this come out of space.com and SETI, you know, this this is, you know, if there ever was a front agency, it's SETI. That their job is to pretend like they're looking for alien life but never find it. And it's, oh, it's going to be in a few years. Oh, it's going to be next month. It's going to be in 5 years. For sure we're going to find alien life. But they never do. They're a front agency. Okay. Whew, okay, got me wound up on that one. Now, this next story is very telling. We all know, we've all heard about the novel coronavirus, the COVID-19. And anyway, here's an article that came out of National Public Radio, and this is another story that's just bizarre when you understand, when you fill in the blanks here. Now, this is a story that nationalpublicnpr.org, and it's, the title is, would the U.S. health system be ready for a surge in coronavirus cases? Seems like a pretty innocuous title, something that should not raise an eyebrow. But, okay, as you read into this, they're talking about some of the workers. And this is being narrated by a Dr. Tara O'Toole, nice Irish name. This is her comment, and I'm just going to read. This is a quote, and this is a comment by biosafety expert Dr. Tara O'Toole. Okay, it says, no one is ready for a worst-case scenario for a really bad, lethal, fast-moving pandemic, says bioterrorism and biosafety expert Dr. Tara O'Toole, former Undersecretary for Science and Technology at the Department of Homeland Security, and now at InQtel, a nonprofit strategic investment firm that supports U.S. national security. InQtel is the CIA. Okay, InQtel is the drug, human trafficking, laundering entity of the CIA. And now look at how they describe it in this article. So this woman worked for the Department of Homeland Security. She's a bioterrorist, bioterrorism and biosafety expert, clearly working in the government capacity. And now she's working for InQtel. And now look at how they describe this. This is the mind blower here. This is the mind blower. It says InQtel, that she's now working at InQtel, which InQtel is is a skeleton association. It's a pass through for drug money from the CIA. That's where they launder their drug money, and they buy high tech companies. And that's where they bought Google, they bought YouTube, all of the media that they own: the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Wikipedia, the YouTube, Google. All of those were purchased by the CIA's excess drug money. And by the way, where does the CIA, where in their budget do they have money to buy hundreds and hundreds of high-tech companies, primarily in the region of science and technology, bioterrorism, and biosafety? You know, where do they get this money? It's not in their budget. It's not in their budget. It's all drug money, laundering money from drug and human trafficking. Okay, and so now look at how they describe InQtel. It says it's a nonprofit. So who's putting all the money into this nonprofit? That's an interesting question. It's a nonprofit strategic investment firm. Oh, it's an investment firm, which it is. It takes the CIA drug money and invests it. That's true. That supports U.S. national security. Doesn't that just sound like, doggone it, that's mother and apple pie all over the place? No. They support the agenda of the CIA. But look at how they butter that on hot toast. InQtel, a nonprofit strategic investment firm that supports U.S. national security. Puke. Barf. I can't believe this. And then she goes on to say, for instance, O2 thinks that hospitals would have a very hard time handling a lot of critically ill patients who need to be in isolation. That's why we want to make sure that the people we're putting in hospitals and keeping isolated are really the ones who need that kind of care. Okay, so in other words, if you go to a hospital, and I had a thing recently where I thought, you know, maybe I should go get checked out. It's nothing serious, you know, but, you know, you have that idea. Maybe I should go to get a test or something and see, you know, maybe you always want to catch things early. Maybe it was just a stomach ache or something like that, or, you know, one of those things. But then I thought, you know, I don't want to go to a hospital with the flu season going on and the, you know, this coronavirus thing going around. The last place on the planet you should go, unless you really got to go there, is the hospital. And so, because it's like center for all diseases and diseases and illnesses, in an infirmary, that do you want to really go to the place where everybody's sick and catch something? You might come out of there worse than when you went in. But anyway, I just, when I saw this article, this ranks up there, right up there with the SETI looking for alien technosignature article. Oh, I couldn't believe it. This is interesting too, just talking about this coronavirus thing. I'll just call it the coronavirus thing because we don't really have a lot of decent information on it. But I saw Congressman Tom Cotton talking about this, saying that they're blaming China and they really think they need more answers from China. But after seeing this article about InQtel being involved in bioterrorism and biosafety and having staff working, this woman is not, this Tara O'Toole woman is not working, you know, in some kind of little office or something. They have serious laboratory facilities if they're dealing with this kind of work. And so, this is the issue here is, did the CIA or one of its sister agencies in other countries plant that virus in China and let it spread? Or did it come from China? Was it some kind of error? There's all kinds of craziness going around on people on the radio making claims. And now when I see this, when you get off-the-wall claims about where this virus came from, making it into the mainstream media and becoming promoted, that tells you that somebody is feeding that information, false stories about the origin of this virus, and to try and basically subvert the public opinion on where it came from. But I'm gonna divert from talking about this. There's really very little information coming out of China. The World Health Organization does not have a shred of information about this. And we really don't know what the status is. Their statistical number and analysis is simply not available. They don't have good numbers. We really don't know. All we know is that, thank goodness for Trump, that he slammed the door, because back in the Bush administration, the Bush 2 administration, they didn't do anything about the SARS epidemic. They let people from the U.S. go there and people came back, etc. But also when I see somebody saying something like that this is probably true, true. It says no one is ready for the worst case scenario of a really bad, lethal, fast moving pandemic. And that's probably true, because the American medical establishment they can hardly manage the business that they have. So where this thing is going, let me just summarize my thoughts on this coronavirus. And you know, people can argue about where it came from. That's like trying to argue what caused the New York Trade Centers to come down. Don't get caught up in that argument. That's a false argument. What's required is to talk to people in the case of this coronavirus. What is the effect on you? How is it going to affect you? And nobody really understood the effects of 9/11, for example, when the Twin Towers came down, that it would completely, radically change your existence, your rights, your entire existence for the next 10 to 15 years. And now we're just starting to recover from that, all of the fervor and all of the everything that happened as a result of that. And right now also, relative to this coronavirus, you are just about as likely to die from the flu as you are from this. But the issue is that this virus does have a cycle, and it can have a second cycle. So you don't want to get it the first time. So my advice is just quarantine yourself. Quarantine your family. Don't go out to, you know, don't go to Disney World. Don't go to the, try and stay away from airports. Try and stay away from public transportation if possible. Don't take the kids shopping. I've said that before because the kids got their hands all over everything. And if you're in an area and you see people say sneezing and coughing, just back off, you know, get away from them, because whatever they got, they're spreading it. You know, a cough, a sneeze, you know, somebody's got kids that are snot, they got a runny nose, touching everything. try and stay away, you know, maybe grab the fruit that's up on the top shelf or whatever. And then do your shopping when there's least number of people in the store. When you get home, wash your hands. And a good idea is too is to take your clothes and put them in an area where they just stay for like 2 days, because the virus can live on things for the better part of a day or a little bit longer. So leave your clothes, sit there, go wash your hands good, and possibly even take a shower. You've been out in the public, just don't pick your nose, don't pick your eyes. Don't stick your finger, your hands in your mouth. Don't eat finger food like hamburgers, things like that, out in public, I mean. And so those are just some precautions, because you just don't know where this thing is going to go. And we're getting very little, just a dearth of information from the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, and the World Health Organization. We are getting absolutely no real information. When they tell you that the probability of you getting this is low, what does that mean? Is that the same as if you stood out in the middle of a crowded freeway with cars whizzing by, your chances of being hit would be low? You know, it doesn't mean anything. Statistically, a low statistical sampling doesn't mean anything. There's no meaning at all. The word has no business, and that's the word they're using. The effect on the American public is low. What does that mean? Excuse me, that doesn't mean a thing. It doesn't have any meaning at all. So just my advice, just stay at home. If you have to travel, if you have to get on an airplane, go on an airport, stay away from people. If there's a crowd, you know, like the crowd right before you get on the airplane, stand off to the side. Wait till everybody's loaded and then walk in either the last one. And there's nothing wrong with that. Just sit in a chair and wait until everybody's loaded and then walk up, give them your ticket, and get on the plane. And if somebody's coughing or something next to you, you know, I don't know what you do. Bring an extra paper bag and put it over their head. I'm not sure. But, yeah, you'd want people coughing. And anyway. That's what I would say. Just chill out, quarantine yourself as much as possible, especially your family, your kids, and wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your hands. This story just took me by surprise. Plymouth Rock being vandalized. Somebody, I saw a picture of it. Somebody took spray paint and sprayed it all over Plymouth Rock. And I couldn't see what it said. I didn't read the article, but good grief. You know, there's a lot of activity by the, you might call them the liberal left, or the loony liberal left, that anything of history they want to destroy because they think it's white supremacist or racist or whatever. Just insanity that, you know, these are historical items and of great importance, really. You know, the rock that the first people came to this country for religious freedom. And now, actually, religious freedom is very much under attack. Okay, enough of that. This is an interesting story about a company called Astra, who has been working in the background. That name really gets around. That's the name of Brad Pitt's movie about rah-rah NASA thing that's called Ad Astra. But anyway, this company is called Astra. It's out of Los Angeles. It appears they have an installation up in Alaska, and they're building small rockets that can lift small payloads into outer space. So that's the idea. Satellites are getting smaller, miniaturizing, and of course you don't need, if the payload is small, you don't need this massive, you know, three-stage rocket to get this thing into space. So they're trying to bring this, the cost down. And I did not hear how the, I think they launched this week. I did not hear how it went. But they're looking at a DARPA award for a couple million dollars to keep their research efforts going. So anyway, hats off to those people. They showed their facility, a manufacturing facility. I wish I had something like that. But clearly they have some investors that are throwing some money at them, because this is a potential future business. But as I said before, the issue of going into space, the real way to go into space is not with rockets. Now, I assume that they're building these rockets to be reusable, that they're not a launch one, you know, use it up and goes away type of thing. But they're talking about these things being so inexpensive that individuals could have a launch and put something in outer space. Like maybe you out there, or maybe your community could get together and build a satellite and put it up into outer space. Anyway, the space is going to get pretty crowded up there. It's a pretty big area, but it's like anything with excessive amount of activity, it's going to be pretty crowded. But the real way to go into space when you're going, especially for small payloads, is you take literally a jet that can go up to probably 50, 60,000 feet. That's no big deal. That's easily accomplished. You just, it would be like a tube, basically like a shoulder rocket launcher, basically, with wings. Take it up to about 60,000 feet. And that's where you let the rocket go from. That's where the rocket would actually launch from. You come back down, you land, you load another one of these rockets into the tube. It goes up, flies up to 60,000 feet. But what is 60,000 feet? Well, the atmosphere at 60,000 feet is about one-tenth that of the atmospheric pressure at Earth. And the reason that's important is because the wind resistance or the air resistance to movement is proportional to the density of the atmosphere. So if you get up to 60,000 feet, now you're out of the thick part of the atmosphere. And if you look at a rocket, the dynamics of a rocket taking off, probably a lot of its fuel is expended in lifting the fuel and the rocket and the payload, which is a very small part of this, lifting it up to 60,000 feet. And after that, now that's where the rocket really kicks in and you take off. That's when you accelerate. You don't want to go real fast in the lower atmosphere because the wind resistance, it goes as the cube of the velocity. And so the faster you go, the more wind resistance, the more energy it takes. So you want to go slow. If you're in a rocket, you want to go slow up to about 60,000 feet. And then you're pretty much out of the thick part of the atmosphere, and you can kick it and accelerate and start moving quickly. Okay, so how do you eliminate that issue of burning a lot of fuel to get up to 60,000 feet? Well, it's much more efficient to have a reusable vehicle that's like a, like I say, a tube with wings. Basically, you come down, you land on the runway, you load back the rocket into this tube, you go up to 60,000 feet, the rocket, you just tilt upwards, the rocket takes off like a, just like I said, a shoulder-mounted rocket launcher. You come back down and land, put another one in, and you could have 20 of these. You could be launching every couple minutes. You know, the same frequency as airliners taking off of a runway at a major congested airport. In fact, you could use the same airport and go up to, and you can put these objects into orbit any place, but it would save tremendously on the rocket and then also the vehicle that actually takes the payload up into orbit. Or if it's just a joyride, you can go up to the edge of the space and then come back down. But Bert Rutan, of course, has been using the similar technique with his White Knight carrier system. And what he did is developed a carrier vehicle with jet engines that could get you up to about 50,000, 60,000 feet. And then you drop the payload off. The other thing they were using that for was just basically testing air designs. You can do wind tunnel testing, you can do all kinds of testing, but there's nothing like a real test in the real atmosphere. You cannot really duplicate that in a laboratory because most aircraft are big and wind tunnels are not big. So anyway, the idea is that that's a simple way to do testing of an airframe and understand its properties, etc. So but anyway, the idea of this company building small rockets to go into space, I believe, is commendable. But eventually, anybody who's building rockets, including Elon Musk, is going to be left by the wayside unless they get on the story of building runway to launch, runway to orbit types of vehicles. Just a quick mention, you probably heard in the news one way or the other about Roger Stone and his this ordeal he's going through with the federal government. And clearly, he's just a victim of being a Trump supporter. But I believe in the next day, or possibly it was today, I'm not sure, he had to, his attorneys had to file a petition for retrial because all of the, well, it's, anyway. So if you want to go and follow that, I believe they're still looking for people to help fund the Roger Stone Legal Defense Fund. That's the name. And it's a .org. I talked about this before. Give them a few bucks or something like that if you can. But a little bit of support. And I mentioned that I would talk about this on my radio show because I believe these people have been railroaded when other people like McCabe and these other people caught lying in front of Congress repeatedly and nothing happens to them. So anyway, you know, it's what they call the two-tier justice system in Washington. Now I'm going to talk about the future of electric. And of course, all of these other topics I like to bring to you because I give you a little bit different analysis than you're going to hear anyplace else. A lot of these you're not going to hear about. For example, the history of Hale-Bopp, you're not going to hear, or the entire woven story of what happened there. I could go on and on about that, about the history of that, of Hale-Bopp, but or the one about NQTEL, the lady working there, and it's a, you know, make it sound like some kind of philanthropic, you know, oh my goodness. What I want to really talk about is the future of electricity. I've talked about this before. And One thing that's very clear, as all of the major car companies move towards producing electric automobiles, there's a major problem, and that is that there's simply not enough electrical generation capacity to support these. We have the de Havilland Beaver is the first real commercial aircraft to fly a completely electric. And, you know, this is the way of the future. Automobiles, trains, I just saw an advertisement for Rivian. I think it's Rivian is it's called. They started building four-wheel drive pickup trucks, all electric. Amazing, amazing. Tesla, of course, is picking up on the pickup truck thing for electric vehicles. And then other automobile manufacturers announced a week or two ago that Hummer is coming out with an all-wheel drive electric vehicle that goes from 0 to 60 miles an hour in 3 seconds, has 1,000 horsepower. Good grief. You know, and I talk about Formula One race cars, etc. So the electric world is emerging in a big way. But now there's some graphs that I was looking at. And if you look at, for example, petroleum in terms of energy usage, and this is by converting the product, whether petroleum or coal or nuclear or natural gas, to British thermal units. So that gives you a baseline of units, energy units, to compare these with. And also they're projecting out to the year 2040 in the graph that I saw. It comes from the what is called the EIA, the Energy Independence Administration or something like that. I'm just going on memory here. But anyway, it was a graph showing the use of the various types of energy. And of course, alternative energy, three-blade wind turbines and solar, are way down at the bottom. I mean, comes across at the zero line. Hydroelectric provides a smidgen of electricity for our needs, but the bulk of it comes from coal and nuclear. That's coal and nuclear and natural gas. And coal is going to decline according to current trends for a number of reasons, and natural gas will increase in supplying the energy needs, both electrical and for all purposes, heating, cooking, all uses combined. And so anyway, the question is, now you're going to take that petroleum contribution of energy. Most of that petroleum is going in the form of energy for automobiles and trucks and transportation. So how are you going to convert that into alternative energy? How are you going to take what is just a smidgen of energy down at the very bottom of the graph and somehow replace this massive amount of petroleum that's currently being used in automobiles to directly power automobiles? And it turns out that there's just no way that the central power companies, etc., right now the number of electric automobiles on the road is minuscule compared to the number of gasoline automobiles. You know, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's growing every day, and the car manufacturers are going into this market. But it's like, what if you produced a car that burned, you know, some other exotic fuel, you know, xenon or kryptonite. Yeah, you invent a car that's going to burn kryptonite, but there's no kryptonite, you know. Superman's got the only little piece of kryptonite, and you don't have it, and so you can't run your car. So that's what they're doing. They're producing automobiles at a breakneck pace. They're trying to all jump into the electric automobile market, but there's no fuel for these. There's not going to be any fuel for these. There's not enough electrical capacity in the United States to produce, to provide these vehicles with energy. It's simply not there, and it's not going to. If we built, Now, if you look at this graph, the petroleum usage is more than coal and natural gas, not combined, but literally, if you said, okay, let's produce more electrical energy to compensate for the fact that electric cars are going to be out there, not petroleum-based cars, and they're going to be filling up with electrons instead of gas and diesel, how are you going to get that extra energy? And it simply cannot happen. There simply isn't the capacity. We would have to more than double the natural gas and coal capacity electric generation to meet the petroleum demand, to replace that petroleum demand. So it clearly is not going to happen. Nobody's building power plants. Nobody's increasing the output supply of power plants. Nuclear is so far down the line, people think, oh, we could just build nuclear. No, nuclear is a 10-year project, getting the licensing and all of the regulatory things that would have to be done for installing a nuclear plant. It would be 10 years. So nuclear is not a solution. Nobody's building natural gas or coal plants. Coal plants are actually shutting down. Where is the electricity going to come from? You know, and anybody that, anybody driving this ship? Is there a captain? You know? Doesn't anybody think about this kind of thing? It's pretty blatant. It's pretty obvious. And I'm not going to repeat. Everybody that listens to this show knows what the real answer is, and I have it. But I'm not going to say it because my fans absolutely understand what I'm doing. And I started doing this a long time ago. That's why I spend really most of my time now. And it's a requirement to get this project underway and get out there. But it's going to happen, and it's just a matter of time. Like I say, that's what I'm dedicating my time to, the X project. Let's call it the X project. You know what I'm talking about. Okay. I do want to mention, I typically try and stay out of political issues, but it was more than fun last night. I didn't watch this entire Democrat debate, but to see them pounding on each other. But the thing is that I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican, everybody should be concerned that a guy who is a billionaire can come in and buy his way into an election and change the rules and all of a sudden be here. He's the same person who took on, basically personally, took on Virginia, sent a lot of money there to basically influence the elections in Virginia. And why are they targeting Virginia? Well, this whole issue of the thousands, tens of thousands of people that went to Virginia to stand up for Second Amendment rights, this was all orchestrated by Bloomberg from New York. So these people are trying to influence elections and the United States, and they're part of the elite. You know, he claims that he made his money the good old-fashioned way. Well, excuse me, you don't get that rich the old-fashioned way, not in this world, I can tell you that. There, you get a little bit of help from somebody's friends, and it's very disturbing that somebody could come in and take over an entire political party with money. So I don't care if you're a Trump lover, hater, a Hillary lover, hater, a Democratic Party lover, hater. I don't care who you are. You should be very concerned that is the route that can go, and then behind the scenes manipulation so that someone can ride in on a white horse and actually write a memo saying that all the other candidates should simply step aside so that he can step in the front line. Okay, the last 10 minutes here, I want to shift to the topic of archaeology, something I haven't talked about for a long time. around the world and using new techniques for looking down into the ground and seeing thermal images, satellite imagery, various other types of remote sensing, archaeologists have been able to detect structures that they never knew about before. This started many years ago in the Yucatan. For example, the Tikal, for example, they now realize is a much bigger set of structures than ever imagined. So what they thought before was that this kind of this central group of buildings, and then everybody else must have just lived in the outlying areas in little huts, etc., that never lasted through the ages. But no, what they're finding is that there are ongoing archaeological structures, very extensive, and now they're finding these not only in, say, the Yucatan, but all over the world. There's another story just came out dealing with the Ukraine, where there are cities, and these cities existed, estimates of 5,000 to 6,000 years ago. Well, of course, that doesn't match up with the concept that civilization began in the Euphrates Valley between the Tigris and Euphrates River, and that somehow all of the populations of the world emerged from that lowly little spot. These don't fit any place in that scenario. And, of course, the people that lived in the, say, in the Ukraine before the time of the so-called emergence of man from the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. And, of course, as I always point out, there wasn't enough time in history for all of the civilizations of man to evolve. The black races of Africa, the tall and the short, and all of the different races in Africa, or the white races that are up through Europe and Northern Europe, or the other races that when you go to the east, the Chinese and the Japanese and the Polynesians, for example. And what I always talk about what I used to do when I would teach astronomy, when I came into the classroom one day and the students were like, they just didn't want to be there. And, you know, I was probably tired too. And, you know, about halfway through the semester, you know, you need that kind of a pick-me-up. And so I'd say, okay, we're going to do something different today. And the students would be like, oh, good, you know. And so I'd say, pick an object that wasn't down the street a week ago. And I would go through this routine where I'd go back through history, all the way back thousands of years. And the students would realize that the discovery of by Western man, so-called intelligent Western man, the discovery of civilizations, you know, the spice route with Marco Polo and all of the other contacts that we had with by ocean, by land, etc. All of these, Vasco da Gama, all of those explorers, Columbus, not the least of which is Columbus, and many more, Magellan, that they discovered large populations in parts of the world where, according to this Mesopotamian theory, there shouldn't have been people, but those people's histories, these people's history, these groups of people, their history goes way back, long before the Mesopotamian alleged birth of man, the cradle of mankind that you've been taught about since third grade or whenever they started teaching that complete baloney. So anyway, with the advent of modern thermal imaging techniques, etc., other types of imaging techniques, more and more cities are being discovered around the world that are simply buried. And of course, this fits the scenario that that mankind is much, much older. How much older? Well, we don't know. But mankind as we know him right now, you know, with the separation, probably potentially could have taken millions of years And potentially in that time frame, the other planets could have been populated or other star systems. And this is all faded from human memory because of major catastrophes. And that's the issue. That imagine that, on a planet far, far away, a long, long time ago in a, galaxy, the way Star Wars starts out, that there were people and that something came along and just destroyed everything. And we know what those things are. They are basically the large comets that come raging through the solar system. And believe me, I don't care who you are, how well-developed your race is of humans or humanoids or intelligent beings, I don't care how well-developed you are, when something like that happens, you better get out of the way because there's nothing you're going to do to stop it. And of course, that's why the powers that be don't want you to know about any of this, because if the public woke up at one point and one day and decided that or that they finally understood this, then the people in power would lose control, because everybody knows that those bozos up there in Washington or Moscow or London or wherever, Rome, wherever, those people can't control that big comet. That's coming in on a careening in on a and nothing's going to stop this thing. Nothing's going to change its course. You're not going to do a thing to affect what's going to happen. And then the case that Belikovsky teaches us, that the comet Venus came through the solar system, did a tremendous amount of damage. And basically, when that happens, it erases history. From that point earlier, everything is lost. And that's why, for example, when Belikovsky was studying calendars, he was he discovered all of the different groups of people talking about the tailed comet, the star with the broom, the broom comet, on and on, all of these terms. So the idea that they're finding these archaeological digs and through thermal imaging, etc., finding these all over the world, says that fits that scenario. And, that the human species is much older. And, I'm going to stop using that word species because it's really, it implies evolution, etc. But anyway, I'll be talking more about this in the near future. I'm about out of time. Remember my webpage, The Whole House Water Filters. Stop showering and bathing and breathing in chemical soup, the major cause of cancer, in my estimation, in the United States. The wing generator, the containers, the new manna food, all on my webpage. A lot more, the paid cast, etc. This is Jim McCanny. My webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.